There was a middle seat open next to me. I ain't want none of them sitting there talking to me the whole damn flight. So I had to turn my blackness up. Oh yeah, white people, that's something we do. It's called managing your blackness. See, white people, y'all can be white all day long. Black people can't be black all day long. Society don't play that. It's messed up. But we have to choose throughout our day when to be black and when not to be. It's crazy. That black dude you work with, that ain't how he really act.
Hello and welcome to The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. My guest this week is Dion Cole. Dion is a stand-up comedian who I first saw when he started popping up on Conan about a decade ago. He was a writer there for several years and did tons of bits with Conan on the show. After leaving, he has gone on to breakthrough roles on ABC's Black-ish and then the spin-off Grown-ish, where he plays Charlie. But stand-up has always been Dion's true passion, and we talked a lot about that in this episode because today, his first hour-long Netflix special, Cold Hearted, started streaming. There is a lot of funny stuff in the special, but I have to admit that some of it also rubbed me the wrong way, and we got into that in this episode as well, which led to what I thought was a really interesting conversation about cancel culture, everyone's favorite topic right now. So before we get to Dion, I want to give my usual reminder to please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know what you think of the show. Who do you want to see on it? What's your favorite episode so far? We would really love to hear from you. But now let's go to my conversation with Dion Cole. Well, Dion, thank you for coming in today. So this podcast is going to drop the day that your new Netflix special drops. So people can watch it right now and probably already have if they're listening to this. So congrats on that. And cool.
Thank you for having me. Too,
yeah. Man. The special is called Cold Hearted.
Yes.
And it's your first like big hour long special on Netflix, right? Or at all.
It's my first hour on Netflix. I had an hour special on Comedy Central before. So yeah, but on Netflix, my very first hour.
Yeah, so that's exciting, and I think it will, you know, these hours on Netflix have become such a big deal in comedy, and they open you up to tons of people.
Yeah.
But you actually, before this, you were featured on the stand-ups on Netflix, which is a half hour a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Did you notice a big effect on sort of your career or recognition after that? Because I've heard that from some other comedians.
Yeah, it was cool. It was a lot of love. It was a lot of love, a lot of people who saw it, and yeah, it was cool. It was really cool.
Did you have any thoughts about doing it or not doing? Because had you already done your hour on Comedy Central when you
yeah
when
did,
you did
hour
it?
On Comedy Central, and the way that Comedy Central did with my special, I wasn't like extremely happy with it, but you know, it was the powers that be at the time, so I just was like, okay, whatever. I loved the special. The special was
what did you not
great
like?
To me. I just didn't like the way that it was promoted.
Mm-hmm.
They told me one thing and it was another, and so anyway,
like what did they tell you? And
I don't know.
It just
fell by the wayside to me. It was like it was exactly what I was scared that it was going to be. Like I was like, if it's going to be a special, let's make it special. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do it if it's not special. And so they were like, no, it's going to be special, and we're going to promote it, and this and that and the third. And I had a few billboards and things like that, and I was cool or whatever. But when it aired that one time, and then that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, they aired it a few other times after that, but it's just I don't think it got, like, the love it deserved, you know what I mean? So yeah, I was kind of like bummed about that or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it does seem like these Netflix specials are getting a lot more attention than maybe some that have been on Comedy Central or other networks.
So when they came to we were about the half hour, I was skeptical at first because I just did an hour. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't want to do no half hour. And they was like, but this is a whole nother audience.
Mm-hmm.
You need to see how this audience is. It's crazy. So I was like, all right, well, now let me see, you know. And my man Robbie over at Netflix, that's my guy. So anything he want, I'm going to do anyway. So when he came to me with the idea, because this was their first time ever doing this.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was like, all right, well, let's just do it. And so when we did it, it was like, man, it was really great. And I always thought to myself, man, now this will help springboard the hour, I think.
Yeah, when I had Ron Funches on the show, one of the earlier episodes, and he was talking about how they offered that to him too, the stand-ups, and he actually turned it down mm-hmm. because he felt like he was, you know, ready for an hour and didn't want to feel like he was going backwards.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, and I also talked to Nate Bargatze, who was in that round with you, the first stand-ups, and he felt like it totally like launched his career. So there's really different perspectives on this.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, like I said, it brought me to a whole nother audience. Mm-hmm. See, what a lot of people, you got to put your pride aside, you know what I mean, and go, I ain't doing no half hour, but you have to put your pride aside and look at it like, this is another audience. Mm-hmm. This is a way, especially if you never done nothing on Netflix, mm-hmm. this is a great way for you to introduce yourself. Give them 30 minutes, have people really buzzing about you, and then when your hour come, you know, there you go.
I mean, you have so many projects going on and have fans from a lot of stuff that you do, you know, mm-hmm. Blackish and Grownish and, mm-hmm. And all that. But was there a tangible effect on in terms of your stand-up audience, like people coming out to see you after that?
Yeah. Like after that half hour, I seen like a little spike in my audience. My audience was getting a little thicker, and it was getting a little thicker, and it was cool. But it wasn't like, you know, like overwhelming over the next day, because it was six of us. I mean, mm-hmm. some people probably didn't even see me on that special because they went to all the other guys or whatever, mm-hmm. or they did see me or whatever. But it wasn't like focus specifically on me, you know what I mean? So, but the people that did see it, they was just like, man, or they remembered me or whatever, and it was cool. And, you know, when I went to their city, it was love. But I think that this is something going to be different.
Yeah, I mean, so now you have the hour. And so once you knew you were going to be making an hour for Netflix, how did you approach it? Did you want it to be different from the half hour that you had already put out?
My whole thing was, you know, I appreciate all of those that love me and follow me and came to my shows and support everything that I do. But with this special, I just had in mind, I was like, man, I want to make those people happy, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I also want to gain new followers and I want to gain new people. So I, you know, constructed my material to hit like everybody, you mm-hmm. know, like a little something for everybody. Almost seemed like I'm all over the place, but. but it was constructed that way to hit, you know, East Coast people, West Coast people, down south, overseas, whatever. It was something for everybody. And for comics as well to look at it. And I'm quite sure some comedians are going to look at it and they're going to be like, some jokes are like low-hanging fruit jokes or whatever. But that's not the case to those that don't want to be a comedy scientist. Everybody ain't no comedy scientist. Some people just want to relate, you know, and so you got to have that with them. But at the same token, I have that for those comedy scientists as well, for them to look at how I construct something and have them break mm-hmm. it down and have them go, oh, wow, I like how he did that. I have a joke on my special that is not a good joke at all, but I did it on purpose in order to get the laugh from it. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, so, I have a feeling I know which one you're talking about. Do you want to say it? Or?
I mean, I want people to see it, but yeah, it's this Arby's joke that I did. And in the Arby's joke, I want people to like see it where they just like it's funny not being funny mm-hmm. sometimes, and that's something that comics can learn. Mm-hmm. Where they can look and they'll be like, you know, everything don't have to be structural like that. Mm-hmm. Unstructural is structural.
Yeah,
if you really think about it. And so it's, you know, the joke is purposely done in order to get a certain kind of laugh that's different than the laughs that I got. Mm-hmm. So if you really look at my special, you'll see, you know, I have what comics consider, it's really no low-hanging fruit to me, but I know how other comics think or whatever, and that's why a lot of them don't even really flourish sometimes, because they're so busy in their heads about how amazing this has to be, when they lose focus on the people and the vibe and vibing with people, because you're so busy with how you construct it that you forget to lose the essence. You lose the essence of who you are being so politically correct and, you know, structuralizing your material to to appease those that are only going to go very well done, and that's it. They're not going to pay to come to your show.
Yeah, the one that I was going to ask you about is not the Arby's one. It's the, I think, comes right after.
Should a dude hold a door for a dyke? This is a legitimate question. I tried one day. I was like, there you go, ma'am. She was like, walk in, nigga. I was like, damn, bitch.
That gets a certain kind of reaction, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you use that moment as sort of a jumping off point to talk about that kind of reaction that, that word gets or that sentiment gets.
Right.
So can you just talk a little bit about why you decided to do that?
And that's another, and I was, and that's another angle. That's another range of me showing you how to use certain words to catapult this whole area we're about to go in. I did that word on purpose in order to get people to see the reaction of people, to show them right in that moment how timid you are, to show you how you can't handle dialogue, how now you wanna tear my head off without even looking at the actual reasoning, which I had a valid reason of asking. Because if you really think about it, I might be really offending someone if I ask them that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So instead of looking at what I'm saying, you want to go, oh, he said this word, when you don't even know if it's a bad word or not. So what I did was I actually used that moment to show, to mirror you and show you how you think and how you are and how you shouldn't do that. You know what I mean?
I did that joke on purpose just to see what kind of audience this is. You know, sometimes these audiences, man, they be so lame. That's how America is now when it comes to comedy. Everybody's so timid with everything. So timid and shit. It's like you can't handle dialogue. I don't remember how America got so soft. Everything is fucking horrible right now because of your lame-ass tolerance. Music suck, movies suck. Comedy is the last raw form of expression. And if you take that away, everything's fucking gone and shit. Because of what you can't handle. I said it's fucked up. And then you try to shun away people who think differently than you. I'm not one of them comedians that's gonna sit up here and spoon feed you all the bullshit that you wanna hear and shit. I'm not. You gotta respect the way another motherfucker think. The more people that we have that think differently, the more opportunity we have for change. You get what I'm saying? You gotta respect that, man. I said the word dyke and y'all motherfuckers clammed up like, You don't even know if it's a bad word or not. And you clammed up. You think I'm gonna risk it all over a motherfucking word? No, motherfucker, I do research when I write these fucking jokes, goddammit. I asked Wanda Sykes. Yes, I work with Wanda on Black, cause y'all called up. I said, Wanda, can I say the word dyke? She was like, yes, nigga, stop calling me this late. I got kids.
You talk about how you you talked to your Wanda Sykes about it,
yes,
and to get her perspective on it. So, what, can you share a little bit more about what that conversation was?
So, I was at work. We both were working on Blackish together, and I told her I wanted to talk to her about some stuff, about a joke. And then I don't remember if we talked right then at that moment, but I remember I She said, well, let me hear it. Mm-hmm. And so I told her the joke, and she was like, And I was like, well, I said, you don't think it's funny? She said, it's cool. She was like, it's good. She's like, it's funny. It's good. She said, just don't call me late at night because I got kids about anything else. She said, to call me about anything else, motherfucker, because I got kids. And I just was like, but is it funny? And she was like, yeah, it's funny. She said, she said, you can say it. And I was just like, cool, right? She was like, and then I was like, man, that's funny. I said, even what you said was funny. Your response to it was funny. And I was like, I'm going to put that in there too. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, absolutely went to Wanda about that, you know, because just how the climate is nowadays.
Yeah, and I think you say something like, you know, I don't want to, like, you think I would say that word and ruin my career,
yeah,
if I, or do something that would ruin my career, which kind of nods to cancel culture, which is a huge topic of conversation
right now.
Cancel
culture is horrendous.
Yeah.
It's like, why do you think that I would end my career on this when you didn't do your research?
Mm-hmm.
You didn't do your research. You thought that's a bad word when we haven't got one, email
mm-hmm.
about that being a word that shouldn't be said,
yeah, I have
or
a feeling,
makes people
yeah,
feel bad.
You might get some after it's on Netflix, but
yeah, but look, I really don't think so, because
mm-hmm.
if you really listen to it, who said that that's a bad word or not? I have no one came and told me anything. If like I've heard the word, I heard other words where we can't say and it makes people feel bad and all that, then I'm like, okay, cool. No one sent me the memo on that. And if I didn't get the memo on that, why do you want to crush my head?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why wouldn't you be like, oh, well, let us let you know now that that is a thing. And then it's like, okay, fine, so be it. But you can't be mad at me for not knowing. How am I supposed to know about your world like that when I'm not in that world?
Mm-hmm.
So if you want me to know about something, then put it out there so I'll know and I'll treat you accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
But I still had a valid point.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of them not liking nothing, it still is a valid point. Do I open the door or do I not?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not making fun of it. The joke ain't making fun of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
It ain't making fun of what your choices is. It don't have nothing to do with any of that.
Yeah.
It's simply, do I open the door for you?
Yeah, and you
have if anyone wants to get mad about that, man, then goddamn, man.
Yeah. I mean, and you have another bit earlier in the special about, I believe, your cousin who's gay, and it's very much like an accepting kind of bit about
yes.
encouraging him to come out of the closet
yes.
and make jokes about that. So.
Yes, so it is one end out of the other. It's
mm-hmm.
like, it's no bashing. It's not my cousin. Like, this is my cousin. Like,
mm-hmm.
I love him to death, and I want him to be free, and I want him to be who he is. It'll make it easy on all of us. So
mm-hmm.
For you to pinpoint something like that, you want to crush me, you want to cancel me, you want to ruin me, and it's really, really fucked up that we live in this era where you can't make mistakes. Because I know growing up, that's how I learn.
Mm-hmm.
I learn from mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been that way. If I ride my bike with no hand and I don't hold the handlebars and I fall, I know to hold them next time.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So I should be able to allow to make mistakes and learn from them. But this culture nowadays, they like, man, you mess up, it's off with your head, man. And it's sad, because I don't trust that you really know what you're doing if you're that perfect and you don't make no mistakes.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think about the whole situation with Saturday Night Live and this guy Shane Gillis, who they hired and then fired a couple days later after all this stuff came up? I mean, what was your reaction to that?
I really don't know the story on that
mm-hmm.
all the way. What was the stuff that came up?
He'd made a lot of comments on podcasts, racist comments, homophobic comments, and they were more in the, I think they weren't really made on stage as jokes. They were more made just in like conversations on podcasts, which I think
mm-hmm.
probably made a difference.
Right.
But there was, you know, there was a lot of backlash, and he had the job, and then a few days later he didn't have the job. So that's, you know, when people talk about cancel culture, I feel like that's one of the bigger, you know, examples of it in recent history. There's also the, you know, Kevin Hart situation with the Oscars. And so, it's, you know, it's
man,
happening
it's,
more and more, right?
It's sad, though, man. It's like you have to allow someone to grow with the times.
Mm-hmm.
You have to. The way things were then aren't the way they are now. And the way things are now won't be in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like you have to know that. For you to try to get publicity and sell stories and magazines all off of somebody did something in the past or whatever, regardless,
mm-hmm.
and you got to look at how harsh that is and
mm-hmm.
what they did in the
yeah.
past.
I think the guy from SNL, it was within the last, you know, few months, so it wasn't like it was happening a long time ago.
Right.
Yeah.
So with him, if that's the case, then he has to be held accountable for
yeah.
that. He should know
mm-hmm.
better. You
mm-hmm.
know what I'm saying? But as far as with Kevin Hart,
that was different.
They went on his timeline and went back 8 years
mm-hmm.
to something.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's sad when it gets to that point where you're searching and fishing for something
mm-hmm.
like that. It's sad. But if the guy did that like a few months ago, then yeah, he's he should know better.
Yeah, do you work?
You know, which is still like, you know, we just living in an era now where it's like, man, you got to watch everything.
Yeah,
man.
Is it something that you worry about? Is it something that you think about?
Yeah, you worry about that all the time. And no one is really who they really are. And that's sad, too, that you won't allow people to be who they are, because then you'll know the real them.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're living in an age you don't know the real person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't, because everyone is, like, watching themselves. Mm-hmm. So now you don't know really who's a real racist right now or not, or who's a real bigot or not right now,
mm-hmm.
because everyone is watching themselves. I like that when you were who you were, so I'll know who you are, and I'll deal with you the way that I need to deal with you.
Mm-hmm.
You get what I'm saying? And I'll be who I am. Mm-hmm. And you just accept that. Not that your feelings are hurt or that you're crushed and you can't handle what I'm saying or nothing like that. No, like, let me be who you are, so I'll know that.
Mm-hmm.
Remember they tried to change the words, the N-word and what is it, Mark Twain?
Yeah, Huckleberry Finn.
They tried to change the words in that in order for it to make it appease today's times.
Yeah.
You would get rid of history like that in order to appease today's times. And that's crazy, and that's how everyone is right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's like everybody's trying to be something that they're not, and it's more scarier than ever, because I might take somebody in my house who hate me,
mm-hmm.
but they act like they love me because they have to be that way. You know what I mean? It's I just try to stay out of everybody's way, you know, and try to just do me, man, as much as possible, and that's it. But this new era, man, everybody want to take you down.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody. And then when people are wrong about stuff, their apology is never as loud as their accusations.
Mm-hmm.
Ever.
Yeah.
Your accusations be loud. It'd be like, oh yeah, he. But then when they find out the truth, they go, oh, and then everybody's quiet.
Yeah. People only like to cover the outrage.
They only want to cover the outrage, man.
Yeah. I find it so interesting that you're on this show, Grownish Now, which takes place on college campus,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of these issues are coming up, and you know, comedians playing colleges and having issues around that.
Right.
Have you done stand up at colleges much?
Yeah.
And what's your experience with it?
Now I just try to stay, like, if I decide to do a college, which mm-hmm. is very, 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 very rare. I just stay as PC as possible, man.
Yeah, you do.
I get in. My point of view really isn't important.
It's mm-hmm.
let me make them laugh the best way I can, and the amount of time I got to do it, and let me go. But I'm not trying to change the world. I'm not trying to give my point of view on anything at any college at all. I'm in and out, promise you.
Yeah, just because you view it as a job, you don't feel like you.
I just don't know about that generation mm-hmm. being able to handle what I have to say.
Yeah.
That's all it is. It's me protecting their feelings
mm-hmm.
and protecting myself.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
Coming up, Dion tells the story of how he first started doing stand-up on a $50 bet. So I want to go back a little bit to sort of how you got your start in comedy. You grew up in Chicago,
mm-hmm,
right? And you started there as well.
Yeah, Chicago.
So what's the? I know there's sort of an interesting story about how you started doing stand up.
Mm-hmm.
What is that story?
A friend bet me like $50 to mm-hmm. go on stage.
Yeah,
and
at an open mic or at a
we went to an open mic and we went. They wouldn't let me on. We went 3 weeks straight, and then finally, when I got on, it was just no looking back.
Yeah,
yeah.
How did it go that first time?
I got a standing ovation.
Really,
standing ovation the first time, man. It was crazy, but I kept doing the same material over and over again. And what makes you is what break you.
Mm-hmm.
So. That only lasted for so long that I kept doing the same jokes over and over again that people was like, all right, already.
So, do you remember one of the jokes that sort of did the best that first time you got up?
I wrote this Sunny Delight joke,
mm-hmm.
and that was like my slam closer joke, and it's horrible now, but then it was like everything. And then it was this other joke I had about this insurance company commercial in Chicago called Eagle Man Insurance. It was
mm-hmm.
the worst commercial ever made, and it was so popular, but I just joked about it, and it was like killer, like in Chicago. So yeah, those was my two hitters.
Who were the kind of comedians that you really looked up to or liked when you were starting out?
Man, Bernie Mac in Chicago. It was like Bernie Mac, Adele Givens, George Wilborn. They were like very, very pivotal. Another comedian, Kenny Howe, very pivotal in my career as far as coming up. A guy named Raymond Lambert, Mary Lindsay, they owned a club called All Jokes Aside, very, very pivotal. Then it was like, you know, just the greats that I went and looked at and studied afterwards. It wasn't like I studied them before because I didn't even know I was going to do stand-up.
Yeah.
But I knew who they were and I loved what they did. But, you know, it was like Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy, Ellen. I watched Ellen before I even knew I was going to be a stand-up. I just liked Ellen, George Garland, Stephen Wright, you know, Mitch Hepburn, like a whole bunch of greats, you know. And these are people that I kind of like thought they were already doing it, but I had this stand up without even really like looking at them. I mean, I seen their stuff, but I really went and watched them after I did my stand up. And these are people I kind of identify with.
Mm-hmm. And how do you feel like your style has evolved or changed, if at all, over this time since you started? I don't know, how many years have you been doing it now?
I think it's like 26.
Wow.
26 years, I think. I believe it's 26. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it has evolved tremendously. It's like I know what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. When then I would just be doing something. If it worked, it worked. Now it's like I can hear something and I can go, oh, I'm not saying that it works. It doesn't go like that, but it's something where I go, oh, I pay attention to it and then I write it down and I go try it and, you know, or I try to, you know, shape it where it works. But confident level, I think, is more has grown more than when I started. I'm more confident to, you know, say what I got to say or perform with other people.
One thing I thought was interesting about watching your new special and the stand-ups is that in both you do something where you pull out a piece of paper and kind of read jokes off of it and cross them out as you go.
Yeah, I'm doing that my whole career.
Good, that's good. What I'm gonna do tonight is I'm gonna try out some jokes. You know, do some jokes. Hopefully they work, and if they don't, then I'll never see y'all again, so it don't matter. Also, I only wrote black material. White people, I didn't know y'all was coming. So just sit there and take that shit. So I was eating dinner with these white devils last week. All right, I won't do those jokes.
How did that start? And do you feel like, is it something that you need to do or it's something that you kind of do to adjust expectations with the audience? Or
it's something that I started doing. I used to be so high in Chicago. I used to forget my jokes. And so I used to go on stage and do that. And then I stopped smoking and I just remember my jokes and people used to be like, where's your notepad at? And I'd be like, huh? And I'd be like, man, no, get your notepad, man. Like, no, that's it. Mm-hmm. And so I'd grab my notepad again and bring it out and people just love that. And then it became something where I was like, man, it's kind of gimmicky or whatever, but it really wasn't. It became something where I was like, well, this is real. Like, the more organic this is, the more fun it'll be. If I'm more real and I'm more like, yo, I'm, you know, I just want to try this out and see if it works and really try it out, then yeah, this works. And so that's what I started doing. And so a lot of jokes, some jokes I would not have never even done before, but I'll go on a TV special or something and do it, and I'll do the joke for the first time then just to get the real response.
Yeah.
Because I think it's funny not being funny.
Are there any of those in the new special that you had never done before?
No. Those was like, all of them were like tight. Yeah. And I want to make sure that special was extremely tight.
Yeah.
I didn't want to like risk nothing, you know. But usually, like if I'm like doing my own, or if I'm doing like I've done specials like in Canada, you know, and I've done like 7 minute special, 7 minutes on a comedy special in Canada, I'll do a new joke right at that moment just so it won't work.
Yeah.
You know, because that becomes just as funny as one that works, you know. And so I've done it on other specials. I did it on Def Jam once.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What do you think the audience likes about it?
I think they just like how deconstructed it is, you know. It's just like, it's just raw and it's real, and it's like it feels like you're on this journey. You're going with me as we're trying to see if this works or not, you know, and it just becomes funny. And now it's to the point where people be like, I'll do a show and people will be like, man, if I do a show and after my show people come to me, man, I brought my girl to see you pull out your notepad and you didn't, man. Like, what's up? You know, I'd be like, oh, man, I just didn't use it this time or whatever, you know. Like, people be, like, kind of disappointed about that. But I don't use it as a crutch. I just like to pull it out and just show range and show something different and add another different style to what I do. Like I said, I want to give you a range of styles when when you see my special. It's just an array of different ways of telling jokes and different ways of doing things, you know, stories, short ones, you know, just different, just have an arsenal, man.
Yeah.
Arsenal.
The other thing that stands out from the special, I think, is how physical it is and how you're, you know, acting bits out throughout.
Yeah.
Is that always something that you—
That's like one of the first times that—
Really? Yeah.
Yeah, because if you look at the stand-ups—
There's not as much of that.
One spot.
Yeah.
And that's my sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
My sweet spot is just standing there, not moving. Like, that's what I do. I don't go nowhere. I do my notes and that's it. But this is the first time that I was like, man, let me be a little bit more animated. Let me move around. I got some stories that need some visual, you know. And so that's what it was. It was like I wanted to kind of like bring a little bit more energy to it. Like I said before, this wasn't for the people that love me already. This was for trying to get a whole new audience, a whole new following of people as well. I mean, it is for the people that love me, but it's also for those that don't know me too. So I had to switch up a lot in order to appease, you know, plenty of people.
Was it scary at all, kind of going out on a limb to do that physical stuff?
Yeah. Like I said, I've been practicing it for some years, you know what I'm saying? And practicing and getting comfortable with it or whatever. So I know exactly what it was. And, you know, it didn't take me out of who I was or whatever, but usually I stand there with a mic stand and me and don't move, you know. But I'm starting to get comfortable with that. And I kind of like it, you know. It just shows another range of what I want to have in my arsenal to move around and be kind of animated.
Coming up, Dion talks about working on The Tonight Show in 2009 when NBC kicked Conan O'Brien to the curb. So I think probably the first time that I saw you was on Conan's show, which I'm sure is true for a lot of people. How did you end up writing on Conan? I think it was on The Tonight Show in 2009 about?
Yeah, I went on The Tonight Show as a guest doing stand-up. With my notepad, I did my whole notepad and everything on there, going off my jokes off my notepad, and was killing. And after I finished, Conan came and talked to me backstage, and we talked about everything but what I just did.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about parking cars, food, the weather, government. We ain't talk about really nothing about what I, all he said was, man, great job tonight. And I said, thanks, man. He said, you killed. I was like, thanks. And then we talked about everything else. And then after that, you know, I left. And a couple weeks later, my manager called me and it was like, he wants you to write for him. Mm-hmm. And I was like, write what? And they was like, jokes. I'm like, huh? I'm like, for what? Like, I don't even get it. Like, him? Why he want me, like, he want me to submit something? They was like, nah, I want you to be here Monday.
Said, that's pretty amazing. He probably saw the notepad and was like, this guy can write.
I don't know what it was, man. But you know what? My whole career has been like that, man. It's just been all vibes, man. Yeah. It's just vibes, vibing with people, man. And we just link up together and just, man, us linking, you know, we make magic. You know?
So I know one of the big challenges of late night writing is that you're, you know, a lot of, especially if you're stand-up, you go from writing for yourself to having to write for this host.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a challenge for you when you started to say, I got to write jokes?
Not really, because I had wrote for other people, like Ricky Smiley, a very funny comic. He was one of the first guys I've ever written for. And I was doing like stuff in Chicago. We had like this sketch troupe called the Forgotten City, and we used to perform under Second City. It was at Second City, and we were called the Forgotten City, and we used to write sketches and stuff for that. And so I knew how to write, but I just couldn't believe he wanted me to write. That was the mind blowing thing. I'm like, yo, this guy wrote Simpsons and Saturday Night Live. Like, yo, he's legendary. Like, what do you want me for? You know? And so it just blew my mind. Blew my mind. They wanted me to write for him. And, you know, next thing I know, we touring and was nominated for Emmys. And it was just all, a whole bunch of great stuff after that, man. Just great, 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 great stuff after that.
Yeah, I mean, you were there, though, for all the drama with the Tonight Show and Jay Leno. So what was it like to be there when that was going down?
Oh, it was crazy, man. It was, I didn't even really realize at the moment how monumental this was because I had just came on board. So I'm still kind of learning in the lay of the land. So, you know, for us to be, and we were rocking and rolling too. Like, we were going. He had me coming out, doing bits on the show. And like, he had.
Yeah,
like,
that happened pretty fast for you.
It happened overnight. Like, as soon as I got there, we just started like rocking it out and putting the stuff out. And like, you know, it's just never been seen, even with him and me and him linking up and just, man, rocking and rolling. So for us to have love, it was like, oh, wait a minute. We rolling, man.
And, yeah, I mean, there was a moment where he was maybe going to move to, like, midnight or something.
Yeah, and that was the reason why he didn't. That's the reason why he left.
Yeah.
He didn't want to compromise the time of the late night show that's been coming on forever at that time.
Yeah.
And now they wanted to move it to 12, and he was like, nah.
Yeah, was that a pretty unanimous in the show? I mean, with the people, or do you feel like some people were like, "Hey, we're gonna lose our jobs if you"?
I mean,
you
it was like that. I'm
this.
Quite sure everybody felt that way or whatever, but it was still his decision, and everybody was behind him 100%. Whatever he wanted to do, we was all like, "Yo, we ready." So everybody was getting their affairs in order, you know, depending on what he said and what he wanted to do. So. But he took care of everybody. He took care of everybody. Yeah, because I think they had a lawsuit, you know, where they got paid like $45 million or something.
Yeah, he got a big payout.
Yeah, so he took care of everybody.
That's good. And then, so he took you on tour after that.
Yeah, then after that, he took me on tour with him.
Was that fun?
Yeah, man. Close out the show, man. Like, that was, he closed out the show, but right before he closed it out, I was that bit right before that, man, and it was such a sweet spot, man. And you know, I met so many great celebrities and great people, man, and just riding around with him and going from city to city. And it was a movement at that time, man.
Yeah, we
there like
really
rocks.
Was.
Oh, we was like rock stars, man. It was like Team Coco all the way.
Yeah,
like,
I remember going to the show at Radio City Music Hall.
Oh,
it was
my
insane.
God.
Yeah.
It was insane, man. And we were like, I mean, like true bona fide rock stars, man, from city to city, man. And I just was like, what is going on? You know, like, I mind you, I just got with him. Mm-hmm. And all of this just started happening, like, bam, 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 bam. So.
And then you stayed on for the TBS show.
Yeah, it came on the TBS show, and then we rocked and rolled for some years over there. And then I had my own show, Black Box.
Yeah. So that kind of spun off at TBS, and you did that show. For how long did you end up doing that show?
I only did like 6 episodes, but the powers to be at the time, man, they were like horrible, yo.
Yeah.
They were horrible. Yeah. Because TBS was a baseball network.
Yeah. They didn't really know comedy yet.
White America. Like, oh my God, it was apple pie and baseballs. That's what it was. So when my show came on, they wanted me to do a like Tosh.0 show. When I was like, nah, we're going to talk about current events.
Mm-hmm.
And they was like, nah, we need like a Tosh. And I was like, So we were talking about real stuff. Like, we were talking about the N-word. We were talking about Amanda Bynes when she was going through her problems. We was dealing with
Trayvon Martin.
We was dealing with real stuff, and it was fun. And people love the show, and my ratings was the same as like Conan's. Like, some days it was like I would have the same the lead in from Conan, I would keep that lead in.
Yeah.
I would keep everybody that watched Conan, they would stay and watch. Like, it was great. But the powers that be, they wanted me to be some kick in the nuts show like that, man. Like, it was just like, and no disrespect to Tosh and all of them or whatever, but even though Tosh disrespected me, though, but it's all love. But I never wanted to be Tosh, you know, and it just, you know, just it is what it is. To this day, people still be like, man, we need that Black Box show back, man. We need it back, man. And I entertained it, and I definitely want to bring it back. I definitely do.
Yeah. Have there been opportunities to do something like that?
Yeah, I had some people talk to me about it. Definitely, they want me to do some stuff with it or whatever. You know,
not at TBS.
Because I was no, not at TBS. I mean, but I would, because it's a whole new regime over at TBS now. TBS is like rocking and rolling now. So everybody that was there when I was doing it, they're all gone now.
Yeah.
So I definitely would do it, but with Black Box, it was just, man, it was like, like, everybody wanted me to keep doing that, man. And it was good. Like, John Oliver's show, his show was, like, off of my show. Like
his Last Week Tonight show?
Yeah, because that's what I did. I did everything that happened the week earlier. I would talk about it. Like, that was the whole spill of the show. That's what was so great about it. And John, when John's show came out, it was the same thing, you know, the same thing. But
his show's done pretty well.
It's doing amazing, amazing, amazing. But they were behind him. HBO was behind him.
Yeah.
And that's all. And that's what I was telling TBS. I said, man, just get behind me. If y'all don't know what you're doing, just you looking at the numbers, we're doing great. Like, just let us keep doing what we're doing.
But so what happened, do you think?
I think that they just wasn't ready for the show, man. And they only wanted, like, white baseball programming at the time.
Yeah.
That's what they wanted, because I think they had like Sullivan and Son and you know, all these other shows that they had, and mine was just like in your face, and they just, I don't know,
they got scared,
man. I don't know what it was. I remember one time I saw a promotional ad for my show that they did, and they didn't come to me about it, and it was like this woman chopping watermelons with her breast, and I was like, and it was like, tune in to Black Box, and I was furious about that.
What did you went to them?
I went to them and was like, what is this?
What'd they say?
And it was like, oh, well, we thought you approved it. I'm like, I didn't approve it. No, I did not. I don't even know what that is.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was crazy, man. But like I said, all those people that were there, they're gone now. And TBS is kick-ass station now, man. Mm-hmm. Kick-ass station. They're doing it.
So what I want to do now is kind of go through some of the stuff that we haven't talked about yet in your career. And if there's just a story or a memory that pops out, that you can think of.
Okay.
So your first movie role was in Barbershop, right?
Yeah.
So what do you remember from that experience?
Man, I remember, not getting in the movie and, all my friends were in it. And so I was very happy for them. And I was like, man, I'm so happy for you guys and all that. Then they called me and told me that one of the guys got put out the movie, and can I get his, they said I could have his role.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. So I had my little two lines and I got in and I did it and I was happy. You know, shout out to Ice Cube for allowing me to, you know, giving me that spot, and said Cedric Entertainer too for agreeing to let me get that. And then when they did Barbershop 2, they called me again to come in and get it in, and I was like, fine, that's great. And then when Barbershop 3 came around, for me to be like part of the Barbershop, the whole cast, it was like surreal, man.
Yeah.
It was like I went from these cameos to actually being one of the cast members in the movie.
Yeah.
And it was great, man.
Yep, White Folk is coming back. And they're trying to make money on the brother, too.
But you see, this ain't about white folks coming back. Most of these new businesses coming in are black-owned. This whole block is gonna get some much-needed upgrades.
You know, they could tear down all this mess around here if you ask me. Change is a good thing. As long as they ain't building no liquor stores and no titty bars, I'm cool with it.
Hey, oh, wait a minute now, Cal. Because they build a titty bar across the street, I ain't never going home. Hey, baby, what's up?
Here's your shit. Now, I burnt the rest of it. So the next time you want to call yourself sleeping around behind somebody's back, first of all, make sure she look like something, because I heard all of your little shit. Your cell called the house, and I heard all 2 minutes of it, baby. No, I didn't hear it. Are you trying to call me a lie? Cause I don't even see how you can cheat on me anyway with your little toddler penis. I hope you had a good time, because the next time you come back to the house, I'm going to get medieval on your ass. I mean, I got a sword, I got an axe, a box of bullets, and I'm going to get both of my baby daddies to jump on that ass.
Damn.
She got to have both of them for him, huh?
Sure.
Ooh, hey. Like I was saying, they build a titty bar across the street, huh? No, I ain't never going home.
Boy, you couldn't go home if you wanted to.
You mentioned Def Comedy. Was that a big deal when you did that?
Def Comedy Jam was probably... That was the game changer, because it showed how unique I was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it showed how unique I was, and the things that I was talking about at the time was like very odd. I think I was talking about somebody in the audience, and I was like, I bet your mother be naked, walking down the street naked with a cape on and a helmet on and some glasses, naked. Pulling a wagon with a car battery in it, naked. Like, that was the way I used to snap on people. But I would constantly just add on all these different things, you know? And so that was people going, what is he talking about, you know? But at the same token, they was like, it's funny. Those who got it. Those who didn't, they was like, he's horrible. So
another show that you did not too long ago is Angie Tribeca.
Yeah.
Which was produced by Steve Carell.
Yeah.
What was that experience like for you?
It was a man. Doing Angie Tribeca was a dream, because I'm in love with slapstick, and I love Airplane.
Yeah, it has kind of that Naked Gun
vibe,
right?
Oh my God, Naked Gun, Airplane, all of that, Zucker Brothers, all of their movies, man. I love them. I grew up on them, man. So to have the chance to film a show like that was like everything. And to be with Steve Carell and Rashida Jones, it was like, yo, man, yeah, I'm in on this one. And so it was good. And again, like I said, anything I ever auditioned for, I never got. Again, even with this, like, I auditioned to be the lieutenant, and then Steve Carell was like, I don't want you being like no screaming black lieutenant.
Like, he was too like, stereotypical.
Yeah, he was like, so I'm gonna write a role for you. And he was like, he said he was watching Full House, and he was like, your name's going to be DJ Tanner. And I was like, okay. And they wrote me into the TV show, man.
Yeah.
Like, just wrote me in it. Again, you know, not auditioning, but just vibing, man, and just getting the role, you know, just all vibes.
Yeah. I mean, and then there's Black-ish, which is probably the biggest thing that you've done in your in your career, and has had the biggest impact.
Yeah.
Is it true that your character was written for Charlie Murphy?
Yeah. That's why the character's name is Charlie that I play. And I went on the show to write for that character. I wasn't even supposed to be on that show because I was waiting on Angie Tribeca to start. Mm-hmm. But they were taking a very long time to start Angie Tribeca. And I was like, well, I might as well go over here and write until Angie Tribeca starts up. And then Charlie decided not to do it at the last minute. Mm-hmm. And Kenya and I, the creator Kenya Barris and I, we sat up and talked about the character Charlie and, you know, like writing for it and, you know, and then he just asked me, like, man, why don't you just, can you go in and play that character? And I was like, sure, you know, thinking it's a one-time ordeal. Mm-hmm. And after that one time, it was just lights out.
Yeah, it's turned into a big thing. I mean, yeah. And now with the spinoff, Grownish, too.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the experience been like on that show?
It's been amazing, man, kicking it with Yara and Trevor and all the kids, man, and mm-hmm. Hanging out with them, man. Most beautiful cast, man, the young cats. They make me feel like I'm a chaperone over there because they're so young and beautiful, man. But it's just, it's so much fun.
Yeah.
They're, so much fun working with those kids, man.
They're not too PC for you?
Oh, no. Chloe and Haley and everybody, Francisca, like everybody, man. Emily, Jordan, Diggy, all of them. Everybody's like amazing, man. And yeah, we just have a good time, but no, they're far from PC.
I know last week's class on the Wu-Tang Clan was overwhelming for some of you all, but please make no mistake. The section on Raekwon the Chef will be on the midterm. Okay? Now, for tonight's class, our lesson is filing taxes. More specifically, filing my taxes. Still more specifically, how do I file my taxes?
How do you feel like, you know, your role on both of those shows has kind of changed your career or changed, you know, the opportunities that you have now?
Yeah, I mean, it just made us household names, man. Mm-hmm. And it made us names. And for us to have that platform, man, to not only be a black face, but to be a black voice was like very important. And, mm-hmm. you know, you don't know till you know, you know. And after years of doing a show, even right now, you know, the importance of it, you know, I tend to look back now, like I look at reruns and stuff and I go, wow, man, we really put in some work, man. Like mm-hmm. we really did this. And to be stamped into pop culture for the rest of our lives is, it's mind-blowing still to me, you know, so.
That's very cool. So we end every episode by asking comedians, what's the last piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard? It could be something you saw on TV, a movie, somebody live. What's something that really made you laugh?
The last piece of comedy that's produced comedy or just...
It could be anything. Produced or someone that you just saw, you know, perform stand-up or just something. Anything you've seen.
Man, what was the last thing that had me cracking up? Oh, well, it's not produced comedy, but...
That's okay.
I have like a... Like my, I call her my sister. It's like a sister to me, man. Her name is Brooklyn. She works with me and does things for me. And I asked her to call a plumber for me. And I said, hey, call a plumber for me because I just moved into this new house. And I said, call a plumber for me. I don't have any cold water. Mm-hmm. And she was like, what do you mean you don't have any cold water? And I said, oh, I meant to say hot water. And she was like, oh, okay. She was like, because it sounded like all your water was just blazing hot coming out your sink. And you didn't have any cold water. Like, just like, so you mean you tell me you cut your sinks on and just blazing, flaming hot water comes out. And your problem is no cold water. And I was like, no, give me some cold water. But I don't know why that cracked me up so much, man. I just... But yeah, that cracked me up, man. That just happened earlier today, man. So yeah, shout out to B. B's funny, man.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in and doing this today.
Hey, thank you so much, man. And I love you all's platform, man. Keep rocking. Keep doing what you're doing, man. And to all the listeners, thank you so much. Follow me on Instagram at DEONCOLE. Thank you so much. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And enjoy the special, y'all.
Thank you. Thank you again to Dion Cole for that great conversation. His new special, Cole Hearted, is now streaming on Netflix. And you can also see him on the new season of Black-ish, which airs at 9:30 p.m. every Tuesday night on ABC. And you can find his tour dates at dioncole.com. If you enjoy this show, please tell your friends and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find the show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week!
I think we know the rest of the story.